Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Today was a historic day for the country. We should all be proud of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and her historic investiture to the United States Supreme Court. More than 100 justices have served on the United States Supreme Court over the past 200 years. But today, for the first time, Americans and people across the world will see four women sitting on the bench. And today, for the first time, Americans will see a black woman serving on our nation's highest court. This is a proud day for America, for our democracy, and in particular for women and black women. This fulfills major promises President Biden made to help make sure our Supreme Court bench reflects the diversity of our nation, and more broadly, to strengthen the judiciary by fighting to nominate and confirm federal judges at a fast rate. He promised his nominees would be experienced, committed to the rule of law, and that they would represent diverse personal and professional backgrounds. Since taking office, President Biden has made 143 nominations. 84 have been confirmed, which is standout progress. And of his 143 nominees, 68% have been women and 66% are people of color. He's nominated groundbreaking first, who would be the first black, Latino, and AAPI judge to serve in their circuit or district around the country. Today, as we celebrate Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's investiture, we also want to celebrate the many others across the country making history. And the president is going to keep building on what he sees as one of his proudest accomplishments, and he thanks the Senate for their leadership on this issue as well. Finally, as you heard directly from the president a short time ago, our hearts are with everyone impacted by Hurricane Ian and also Hurricane Fiona. The president remains in regular touch with the state and local officials and spoke with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster this morning. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell is also on the ground in Florida today. Since before the storm made landfall, President Biden has been clear that it is a priority for the entire administration to get those impacted by the storm help that they need. 1 week ago, the president issued an emergency declaration for Florida, which meant we could pre-position teams and resources like food, water, and generators on the ground. Yesterday, the president did the same thing for South Carolina in anticipation of the storm hitting there. Currently, efforts are focused on saving lives and search and rescue as part of an unprecedented level of coordination with the Florida National Guard and state and local responders. Teams started search and rescue missions before daylight yesterday and are continuing that effort today. By the end of yesterday, they had already saved hundreds of lives and completed thousands of structural assessments, allowing people to safely return to their homes. Federal teams are continuing to assess damage and work to restore critical services, ensuring emergency power is available to critical infrastructure like hospitals, and evaluating bridges, airports, and ports as well. We're also continuing to support the people of Puerto Rico as they recover from Hurricane Fiona. We're providing support for emergency response, recovery, and power restoration efforts, and covering 100% of the cost of public assistance, debris removal, and more. We have over 1,000 federal response workers on the ground, and we are providing millions of dollars to repair highways and bridges as well. We are also investing millions of dollars to make Puerto Rico's infrastructure, including its power grid, more resilient to climate change. The people of Florida, South Carolina, Puerto Rico, and everyone impacted by these storms have the full support of the federal government. And as you can see today, finally, we are joined by National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan at the podium to talk about the United States' response to Russia's attempts to annex parts of sovereign Ukraine. And with that, I will let Jake take to the podium. Go ahead, Jake. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Corinne. As Corinne said, I will have an update for you all on Russia, but first I want to take a moment, just as Corinne did, to acknowledge the devastation of Hurricane Ian and the millions of people who have been impacted by this terrible storm. And as Corinne said and the President said earlier today, our hearts are with the people of Florida, South Carolina, and the Southeast. As President Biden made clear, we're going to do everything we can across this White House and across this government to support the people who have been impacted by the storm with the full resources of the federal government as communities endeavor to recover and then to rebuild. I also want to say a special word of thanks to our first responders at every level of our government for everything they are doing and for the life-saving and dangerous missions they've undertaken over the last 2 days to keep people safe. And if you'll indulge me, just a word on what was a very important foreign policy development yesterday. President Biden hosted a historic U.S. Pacific Island country summit. He released the first ever U.S. Pacific Island strategy. He announced over $810 million in additional expanded programs to help these countries combat the climate crisis, provide development assistance, enhance maritime security, and more. And finally, President Biden and all 12 Pacific Island presidents who joined him here at the White House for this summit issued a joint declaration to strengthen our partnership and to chart an affirmative vision for the region. Today, as you all saw just a little bit ago, President Biden issued a strong condemnation of Russia's fraudulent attempt to annex sovereign Ukrainian territory. This act is a flagrant violation of international law, and it has no legitimacy. Unfortunately, it's also not surprising. It's straight out of Putin's playbook of deceit, disinformation, and aggression, and we've been warning about it for months. In fact, I've stood at this podium and warned about it several times, including as recently as last week. Based on our information, every aspect of this process was pre-staged and falsified under orders from the Kremlin. The sham referenda were held at gunpoint. Ukrainian civilians were forced to cast ballots through coercion, intimidation, and in some cases under the watch of armed guards. Saying that it somehow reflects the will of the people is an absurdity. The United States will never recognize these actions. The world will never recognize these actions. And we will stay the course, as the President told you earlier today. We have built, led, and maintained an extraordinary and coordinated response with our allies and partners, and that response will continue. As President Biden said, we will not be deterred. So what does that mean specifically in reaction to what has just happened? First, as we saw from the Treasury Department and as the President underscored, we are sending a clear warning from the United States government, supported by all of our G7 partners. We will sanction and impose export controls on any individual, entity, or country that provides political or economic support to these attempts at annexation. We have put in place authorities to enable us to do that rapidly and efficiently. We are also announcing new sanctions today that target additional Russian government officials and leaders, including State Duma members who are accomplices in these fraudulent actions, and including the Central Bank governor. We are also sanctioning Russian and Belarusian military officials, and we have specifically targeted defense procurement networks, including international suppliers supporting Russia's military-industrial complex. Second, we will continue to provide military equipment so that Ukraine can defend its territory and its freedom. Today, President Biden will sign legislation from Congress that contains more than $12 billion in additional funding for Ukraine, and we are grateful for the continued support. There is no stronger, more bipartisan rebuke of what Russia has just done, no more timely rebuke, and no more assertive statement that we can make through resources and not just through words, that we are going to continue to help Ukraine defend its territory and to deoccupy those parts that Russia has occupied. Earlier this week, we announced a significant new billion-dollar arms package, which included 18 new HIMARS for Ukraine as part of our long-term commitment to strengthening Ukraine's armed forces over the years ahead. And we expect to have another announcement of immediate security assistance to announce next week. Next, the United States and the international community have been crystal clear that we will use diplomatic tools at our disposal to fundamentally reject Russia's attempts to take its neighbor's territory by force. Today, the United States is supporting a resolution at the UN Security Council to condemn these sham referenda and to call on Russia immediately to withdraw its forces from Ukraine. If Russia seeks to shield itself at the Security Council, the United Nations will work with partners around the world to take action next week at the UN General Assembly. Leaders around the world have spoken out about what's at stake: the independence of the democratic nation of Ukraine, the principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity, and the very foundation of the United Nations Charter and the modern international order. As the Secretary General of the United Nations said yesterday, quote, "It must not be accepted, and it will not be accepted." To put it simply, the regions of Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia remain Ukrainian territory. Ukraine has every right to continue to defend its sovereignty, which the people of Ukraine are doing bravely and courageously every day with the support of the international community. And the United States, for our part, under President Biden's leadership, will support them at every step along the way for as long as it takes. And with that, I'd be happy to take your questions. Yeah.
Ukraine is seeking accelerated membership in NATO. Is that something that's possible or something you would seriously consider?
The United States has been clear for decades that we support an open door policy for NATO. Any decision on NATO membership is between the 30 allies and the countries aspiring to join. Right now, our view is that the best way for us to support Ukraine is through practical on-the-ground support in Ukraine, and that the process in Brussels should be taken up at a different time. Yes.
Thanks, Jake. In his speech this morning, the president called the Nord Stream pipeline attacks, quote, "a deliberate act of sabotage," and he said, "now the Russians are pumping out misinformation and lies about it." Should we take that to mean that the U.S. now believes that Russia was likely responsible for this act of sabotage?
Well, first, Russia has done what it frequently does when it is responsible for something, which is make accusations that it was really someone else who did it. We've seen this repeatedly over time. But the president was also clear today that there is more work to do on the investigation before the United States government is prepared to make an attribution in this case. One of the practical reasons for that is that because gas is emanating from these pipelines, the Danish authorities and other authorities in the Baltic Sea can't actually get down to the source of the leak to do forensics on what appears to be an explosion. So we will have to wait until a combination of physical inspection, intelligence gathering, and consultation with our allies to make a definitive determination. But what we can say unequivocally is the suggestions Russia has made about the United States and other countries are flat out false. Russia knows they're false, but of course this is part of their playbook.
But how many countries or entities are even capable of carrying out the kind of attack that we saw with hundreds of kilograms of explosives 250 feet below the surface of the sea?
Not many. And I think this is obviously an act of sabotage that took place, we believe, in the neighborhood of 70 to 80 meters, 230 to 270 feet under the ocean. You know, that takes some degree of sophistication. But I don't want to get ahead of myself in terms of asserting how exactly this happened or who exactly did it until we're standing on solid ground. We will continue to work with our allies and partners to gather all of the facts, and then we will make a determination about where we go from there.
Jay, yes. Two questions. Putin clearly had nuclear weapons on his mind today when he was giving this speech. He said the West is deceitful, hypocritical. The United States is the only country to have used nuclear weapons. And he said, by the way, they have created a precedent. How worrying is that to you?
I've been clear myself, President Biden has been clear, our administration has been clear, that there is a risk, given all of the loose talk and the nuclear saber rattling by Putin, that he would consider this. And we've been equally clear about what the consequences would be. We have communicated that directly to the Russians. We do not presently see indications about the imminent use of nuclear weapons. We are, of course, monitoring that carefully and staying in close consultation with allies and partners. But this is something that we are attuned to, taking very seriously, and communicating directly with Russia about, including the kind of decisive responses the United States would have if they went down that dark road.
Is the risk of that higher now than it was 6 or 7 months ago?
Well, what's interesting is that at various points over the course of this conflict, including right at the outset, Putin has brandished the nuclear card. He's doing it again. So the risk has been there from the start. It's there today. I'm not going to characterize its exact level, only to say that we have been taking this seriously for some time, and we continue to take it seriously now.
Can I ask one broader question before you move on? What lessons from 2014 and from Crimea are you using now? What did you learn from that you're applying here?
Well, there's a number of just in terms of the tactics of how things unfolded in Crimea, including the fact that you didn't have the kind of sustained military conflict associated with it that you do in these cases. That means you cannot draw the analogy too far. On the other hand, one of the things that we have been clear about from the start of this conflict, and even in the months that preceded it, when I stood at this podium and warned that it was coming, is that we were going to be prepared with clear, swift, and very certain responses. And so when I stand here before you today to talk about sanctions, to talk about new funding, to talk about new transfers of military equipment and diplomatic initiatives that are unfolding the very day that Putin gives his speech, that is all the product of months of planning and coordination with our allies and partners so that we do not allow time to elapse, so that we seize the diplomatic initiative, and so that we communicate very clearly we will not accept this, and we will help equip the Ukrainians to push back aggressively against it, even as we rally the international community to condemn it. That has been our strategy from the start. We have tried to be as clear and transparent about that as possible, warning what was going to come, indicating what we would do, and then following through and doing it. And that's what we're doing today.
Yeah. Thanks, Jake. Would the U.S. actively enter the war if Putin used nukes on Ukraine?
So I have said before that we have had the opportunity to communicate directly to Russia a range of consequences for the use of nuclear weapons and the kinds of actions the United States would take. I have also said before that we are not going to telegraph these things publicly. And so all I can tell you is that the Russians understand where things stand on this issue, we understand where things stand on this issue, and I will leave it at that.
Do we run the risk, though, if we're not moving more firepower to Europe right now, that we would be unprepared for a serious response if he were to take that kind of action tomorrow?
President Biden, even before this conflict began, moved a substantial number of additional U.S. forces on land, sea, and air to Europe. After the conflict got underway, within 72 hours, he had ordered the movement of even more forces beyond that. So we are standing at a level of enhanced force posture across the eastern flank in the major maritime domains and with all of the capabilities we need in the air as well. We feel that we have in place right now the capacity to effectively deter and respond to any contingency and to make good on what President Biden emphatically reinforced today, that we will defend every inch of NATO territory. The United States has put in place the pieces for that. And if you look at what our NATO allies have done in terms of surging their own capabilities to Eastern flank allies, upping their own defense expenditures, we are at a level, a state of readiness to take on any contingency, and we're doing the active coordination and scenario planning to be prepared for whatever comes our way.
Is there anything we can do to protect energy infrastructure now before something that's actually in use gets attacked in Europe?
The President mentioned today, actually, in response to a question, that we have, in fact, begun coordinating with allies to increase surveillance and monitoring of energy infrastructure, including pipelines in the Baltic Sea. And we will continue to work closely with Norway and other countries that have come out publicly and announced that they are stepping up their efforts in that regard. The United States has capabilities to be able to bring to bear, and we are bringing those to bear.
Can you describe a little for us about the scenario planning? I would think that when this war began, there was a certain category of planning that has gone on. And how significantly has that changed as the facts have changed, as these threats have changed? And does it suggest that this is a very dynamic situation where is the president engaged in approving new plans on a frequent basis, or is this something that is part of a ready playbook that would already be at the disposal of the Department of Defense, or is this something that's being retooled in real time?
There are elements that are consistent and elements that are dynamic. And what I mean by that is, from the very beginning, we've known the broad categories of forms of escalation that Russia could conceivably undertake. We've known the broad categories of contingencies that we might face, our allies might face, and Ukraine might face. But of course, as time goes on and circumstances change on the battlefield and broader diplomatic circumstances change, and as we gather new intelligence, we can refine the contingency planning within those broad categories to be more specific about different scenarios. And so over time, the president gets updates on the intelligence, updates on the likelihood or lack of likelihood of different circumstances, and refinements in the planning that's taking place across every element of our government, including the Defense Department, the intelligence community, the State Department, USAID, the Department of Energy, the Department of Transportation. We have people, experts from across our government working on a range of contingencies, and the president is in regular touch with his National Security Council principals to get updates on this and to give direction about how to continue to refine and sharpen these plans. The other thing that's happened is you've seen this steady stream of engagements President Biden has had with foreign counterparts, particularly in NATO, the G7, the European Union. That has been an opportunity to engage on different scenarios and to make sure that the leaders of these countries are directing their teams to coordinate together so that we can have a common playbook for how we respond in different circumstances. That's been a very important planning function that's almost unprecedented in the intensity and frequency of engagement at the leader level in a circumstance like this. Yeah.
Jake, I wanted to ask you about the sanctions. I know we've had batches of sanctions rolled out for the last, say, 7 months, and I wanted you to help us understand what makes you all confident that these latest sanctions would deter or change Putin's behavior when thus far we have not seen his behavior change.
Well, so first, one of the key elements of our sanctions strategy has been to reduce the capacity of the Russian military machine to regenerate its ability to threaten Ukraine. And we think we have had an impact on that, denying inputs to the weapons of war that Putin wants to manufacture and place on the battlefield. Second, we have wanted to undermine Russia's major sectors in technology, in industry, and of course in defense, so that its capacity to project power, threaten and coerce its neighbors, and wage wars of aggression is reduced over time. And we think that there is demonstrable progress on that front as well. Third, we want to send a clear message to the rest of the world that those companies, those individuals, and those countries that are going to stand beside Russia on this issue of illegal annexation, they will subject themselves to sanctions, and we do believe that that will have a considerable deterrent effect and have seen that in other circumstances. So for all of these reasons, we feel that the sanctions element of our strategy, the economic pressure that we are placing on Russia, and the denial of their ability to gather what they need to be able to regenerate their war machine, this has been a critical element to how we have prosecuted our strategy so far, and the impacts of it will continue to be felt month on month as we go forward and put us in a stronger position and Russia in a more disadvantaged position as this unfolds.
Follow on annexation. Can I just ask real quick on sort of the broader view of U.S. policy on annexation? Is it U.S. policy that any land gained by defensive or offensive war cannot be legally annexed?
It is the U.S. policy that the attempt to annex at the point of a gun, to conquer territory, hold sham referenda, and then declare that territory your sovereign territory and not your neighbor's sovereign territory is as flagrant a violation of the UN Charter as possible. And this case is cut and dried. And it's for that reason that the UN Secretary General, who has been a careful voice, a neutral arbiter in multiple efforts on diplomacy between Russia and Ukraine over the last 6 months, came out with an absolutely unequivocal statement in this regard yesterday, and every word of it is something that the international community can collectively stand behind. Yeah.
Do Russia's actions give you any second thoughts about enacting the oil price cap policy, which essentially would encourage countries to buy Russian oil at a discount as opposed to a full-out global ban?
We're continuing down the road of negotiating alongside our G7 partners and working with countries who are purchasers or prospective purchasers of Russian oil, what the parameters in terms of a price cap would look like. We are not currently discussing a change in that policy, but rather continuing to find ways to both protect global energy markets and to deny revenues to Putin to feed his war machine. That is our fundamental objective. We believe this is the best method by which to achieve that objective, and we're not looking at a fundamental course correction on that at this time. Yeah.
Are you concerned there could be attacks on U.S. and Western infrastructure after the Nord Stream 1 incident?
We have to be concerned about the possibility of Russian action, Russian aggression against Western infrastructure, Western facilities. We have been concerned about that from the beginning of the war. We don't have any specific intelligence to share with you today on that, but that is the reason we do contingency planning. It is the reason that we send strong deterrent messages like the president today saying that the United States will defend every inch of NATO territory. And it's why the president said today that we've elevated our surveillance and monitoring of critical infrastructure in NATO territory in the event that it is put at risk, either physically or through cyber means or otherwise, and we will continue to do that.
There is a heightened concern about that possibility.
Well, before this war even began, I stood at this podium and said the possibility that we could see attacks in the United States, cyber attacks, or we could see attacks in Europe, whether physical or cyber, was real. It was real then, it remains real today, and what happened with Nord Stream 1 and 2 only reminds us that it is real. Yes.
Thank you. There is a clear nexus between Russia and Iran regarding the drone program that threatened Ukraine. How worried are you about this, and is there any way to stop it? And will you impose more sanctions on Iran in the aftermath of the killing of Ms. Amini that you yourself condemned, and also they issued some sanctions, but do we expect more sanctions on the Iranian regime?
We continue to condemn the brutality and the repression against the brave citizens of Iran, the brave women of Iran, who are simply marching for their rights and their dignity and their justice. And we continue to stand with them, not just in word, but indeed we have issued several sanctions against Iranian entities for what they have done in this killing and brutality. And yes, we will continue to look for targets to impose sanctions in response to these brutal human rights violations. We have also issued sanctions with respect to the transfer of UAVs from Iran to Russia, and we are looking for additional methods to reduce Iran's capacity to be able to manufacture and then to sell these kinds of systems to Russia. We will continue to work on that. And the entire world should see that Russia, as it runs into problems being able to regenerate its own capabilities, has to turn to other countries to try to get a hold of whatever kind of precision munition it can, including Iranian UAVs, that this is a move Russia has been forced to make because it is being denied inputs. And we're going to try and cut off other countries who Russia would seek to go out and approach to get these kinds of weapons to be able to feed their war machine in Ukraine. Yes.
Can I very quickly ask whether the profile of weapons and stuff being sent is changing, and in particular whether you have a view on whether tanks should be provided to Ukraine either by the U.S. or by other countries facilitated by the U.S.? And separately, what we have you, it's been about a year since that AUKUS deal was announced. I'm wondering if you have any update on the status of that. Are the Australians going to be buying American submarines, British submarines, or a combination of the two?
Actually, our leaders just recently put out a statement following the one-year anniversary of the AUKUS announcement, which took place last September, just over a year ago, and we've made substantial progress over the course of the past year. We feel very good about the trilateral cooperation on the submarine program. We think that we have a good path forward. I'm not going to get into specifics on exactly what the nature of the platform will be. That some of the details of that need to continue to be worked out, but even more importantly, I need to protect the sensitivity of it. I will just say that our three countries are very much on the same page about the path forward, and there has been significant progress from concept 1 year ago to now the process of actually putting this in place. We also are pursuing a significant number of advanced capabilities through the AUKUS partnership in cyber, artificial intelligence, and other areas. We've seen significant progress on those as well, and there are certain areas where we are looking to bring in other partners as well as part of an open platform approach. With respect to tanks, we actually have facilitated the provision of tanks to Ukraine from some of our Eastern European partners who have provided the same type of Soviet-style tanks that the Ukrainian Army trained on and is in possession of, and we will continue to do that. In terms of other weapon systems, what the President announced this week was a further provision of HIMARS, which we have provided before. We expect the next package will be a re-up of many of the capabilities that the Ukrainians have moved so effectively, and I don't have any announcements of new and additional capabilities beyond that.
NATO standard tanks, the Abrams tanks, Leopard tanks, like a higher, more modern tank, that's what is being sought by either the Ukrainians or advocates for it. Are you ruling that out, or is NATO ruling that out?
I'm not ruling anything out. I will say I don't have any announcement on a U.S. tank today. And in terms of German tanks, I would refer you to the Germans who are in their own consultations with Ukrainians on that.
Yeah, thanks, yeah. Jake. Senators Blumenthal and Graham introduced legislation yesterday that would cut off U.S. military and economic aid to nations that recognize Putin's annexation of Ukraine. Does the White House support this proposal, or would it consider such a policy move like this?
So I haven't had a chance to read the legislation, and in these circumstances, the details end up mattering. But at a broad level, the basic proposition that we should be imposing economic costs on countries, individuals, and entities that are providing political and economic support to these annexations, not only do we agree with that, I just announced that from this podium today. We are going to do that ourselves under executive authority. And I want to issue a clear warning to those who would think about providing political and economic support to these annexed territories or to Russia's efforts to justify and defend the annexation. You can be subject to U.S. sanctions as a result of those activities. We look forward to working with Senators Graham and Blumenthal on an approach in the Congress that could be consistent with and help drive that forward.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, Jake. A couple of questions on Ukraine and then a follow-up on Iran, if I may. I'd like to get the administration's reaction on President Zelensky's statement saying that we are ready for a dialogue with Russia, but with another president of Russia. That's my first one. And then the second one is, we understand that U.S. diplomats have been pressing Russia's allies to convince Putin to de-escalate. Can you be more specific about those kinds of overtures? In what ways does the administration believe that China and India can apply more pressure on Moscow to de-escalate, not go the nuclear route?
So on your second question, we think any country that believes in the principles of the UN Charter, and frankly, that should be every country that signed up to the UN Charter, should be taking on its measure of responsibility to communicate directly to the Kremlin that what it is doing is wrong, it is unjustified, and it must stop. And we are asking that of countries around the world. We'd like them to speak out publicly, and we would like them to convey things privately, diplomatically. With respect to the first question,
Zelensky saying that he's ready for a dialogue with Russia, but with another president of Russia.
President Zelensky has consistently said throughout this conflict that the war ultimately will end through diplomacy, and we have consistently backed him up in that. I would have to refer you to him on that precise statement and what he means by it, but what I will tell you is that we have had daily engagement with the president, his chief of staff, his foreign minister, his defense minister, and much communication, of course, between our military and their military to make sure that we are understanding one another well, that we are transparent about the support we're providing and the strategy they're pursuing. That continues today, and that will continue every day from here on out.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly! Parts.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run Finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.